This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Sashika Marchand Balshaw producing today. And Robert Travis Scott is our leadoff guest of the week, the president of PAR for the last 3 years. For 8 years, he was a Capitol Bureau chief for the Times-Picayune, and he is a man who's been around the world in his journalistic endeavors, spent much of his time in the great state of South Carolina, which also has a governor of Indian American extraction. And Robert Travis Scott is here to talk about political matters as much as he can, but he is the pundit from Park Boulevard. Good morning, Robert Travis Scott.
Good morning, neighbor. How are you?
I'm fine. The big question is, are you going to be in the Gridiron Show this week?
I'm not going to be in the Gridiron Show. No, I plan to attend, though. I hear it's a really funny show this year.
Well, it's always funny, and they have some very talented people who are involved every year, year after year. Mike Haston's been there a long time, and we've got
Chuck Well, some Barrett of their best there. Skits have been takeoffs on Jim Inkster, well, so that's what we're waiting to see if they do another one of those.
I don't know about that. I enjoyed them, but I don't know if others did. But Leo Honeycutt, he did me better than me.
Leo Honeycutt did a better Jim Inkster than Jim Inkster. It's true. And I played David Vitter a few times.
I know.
And that was a lot of fun. But
I know. And the Smiley Anders, the only man who takes his shirt off more than Vladimir Putin is Smiley Anders.
They always find a way to get Smiley's shirt off.
And I hear Darren Mann this year has been playing Arnold Schwarzenegger. Instead of using the fake muscles, he'll use his real muscles. So we may see Darren with his shirt off as well.
Well, I don't know if we're
we don't want to drive
I don't know if we're driving people to the show or away from it. So.
But at any rate, there's much happening at the Capitol right now. And Governor Jindal is criticized by some for flirting with being president of the United States. He's out making his case that he should be the leader of the free world and take the oath of office as the 45th American president on January 20th, 2017. You've been following him a long time. In fact, you're one of the few, if only, journalists I know who went to India to cover the Jindal story. What do you think about his backstory and his chances to become the president of the United States of America?
Well, he does have an interesting backstory. You know, the story of his parents coming over and at a time when he was actually in the womb and then born here, and they made quite a good living for themselves, and he grew up in a culture that was very different from the one his parents grew up in. And I think he wanted to sort of make himself an American as he grew up, little by little. There were lots of things that he did where he really wanted to be, you know, somebody from Louisiana. I think basically he is a Louisiana guy. You know, his ambition has always been very, very high. He's wanted to be president of the United States as long as I've known him. And that's been his eye on the prize all this time. And right now he's out, I think, trying to keep the United States from sliding into a new Cold War with Russia. And he's talking and pontificating on issues about national politics. He's making steady attacks on President Obama. And he's trying to also, I think, sort of polish his credentials on foreign policy issues. So he's doing what he thinks he needs to do to prepare himself for the election. Of course, he's making a lot of appearances out of state, a lot of appearances in a lot of those key early voting states in the primaries.
Well, Governor Jindal wants to be president, and if so, he'll certainly be interacting with Vladimir Putin. And we mentioned him. Maybe there'll be a skit on Putin in the Gridiron Show as well, but I was just looking at some of the reflections about Putin today in the New York Times. Bush, the old quote, "I looked the man in the eye and I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. I could see his soul." Well, Bush's defense secretary, Robert Gates, said, "I looked into Putin's eyes and, just as I expected, saw a stone-cold killer." So perception is different, and there are some perceptions about Governor Jindal that this is a foolhardy endeavor, and there are others that say, look, this guy's got as good a chance as anybody, be good for Louisiana. He should go for the brass ring. AJ writes, "Jindal is neglecting us for higher office. I want him here doing his job or explaining why on earth does he continue to suck the life out of the Louisiana working poor who could benefit from the federally funded Medicaid expansion." Your thoughts, Robert Travis Scott.
Okay, thanks. Well, I think Jindal is out there trying to get his name more and more recognized. I think he wants to be a household name across the country. And so I think that's a lot of his motivation for a lot of what he's writing and the way he's writing it. He talks in very aggressive tones about, you know, putting on your big boy pants, and even sometimes talks about, you know, sort of beating up the opposition, if you will. So he likes to do a lot of tough talk. He likes to try to get some headlines. And I think part of the reasoning for that must be that the more people who go to the mm-hmm. take these survey polls, they tend to mark those people or say they might vote for those people that they've heard of. So Jindal wants to be one of those people that they have heard of.
Yeah, as Foster Campbell noted, he came out of having breakfast with the president and then got before the cameras at the National Governors Conference, and he tore into Barack Obama, the man he wants to succeed as president of the United States. Josh on I-10. Josh, good morning. You're on the air with Robert Travis Scott of PAR. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you doing? Good morning. I have a few words about our governor I wanted to ask Mr. Scott if he would comment. There's a couple of things that impressed me about Jindal. One is arrogance. The other is elitist. Condescending is a good word. What I'd like to ask...
Can't you say anything nice about the man? What's your problem, Josh?
Not that I can think of. What I'd like to ask Mr. Scott is about the elitism and the world dominance view of the Rhodes Program, and whether or not he has any insight about how the Rhodes Program would have influenced both Clinton and Jindal.
Okay.
Yeah, and
David Bitter, too.
Yeah, David Bitter. I guess he's referring to
the Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, the program of the Rhodes Scholar, in which you travel to England for these studies. I guess some people have called it a nice sabbatical while you're over there to think and to interact with people overseas. And so Bobby's done it, and David's done it. And who else?
Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton, yeah, and others. So, but I, you know, what I hope comes out of that is a more cosmopolitan view of the world, and a view in which that's informed by not just an insular place that you came out of in the United States, but it's a view that's informed by a broader world and a broader audience. But, mm-hmm. you know, these gentlemen are dealing with politics, and I'm not sure how much Rhodes Scholar perspective they're bringing back so much as they're bringing back a political perspective in which they're trying to either, one, get things done according to their ideology, or two, you know, blow with the political winds and as to what's popular and to go with that point of view. I think that's a more motivating factor for these people than the Rhodes Scholarship experience.
297-5633. Thank you, Josh, for your insightful comments. 297-5633 is your number if you're dialing locally, and we've got some lines open for Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council. Now, Jindal's quest to be president, at least for the near term, has been overshadowed by Governor Edwards getting back into the political realm as a candidate for the 6th District Congressional seat. A man whose middle name is Washington, who served in Washington for 7 years as a U.S. congressman, has been criticized both from the left and the right for his newborn political endeavors. Bob Mann wrote a column with a headline in the Picayune that read, "A Farce to be Reckoned With." Bob doesn't like our former governor too much. What do you think? He did his time. He served with some grace and character, and he got out, and he's a free man, and he's inclined to run.
Well, as you know, I don't believe he can run for a state office. He would be prohibited
he
from
says
that.
He says he can. For a state office, unless he were part. He's right.
Right. But he does seem to think he can run for Congress.
He's running for Congress. If he gets a presidential pardon, he can run in the state, and perhaps that's the grand plan, is that he gets elected to Congress, gets his pardon, and then runs for governor again. But at any rate, what do you make of his quest to become a U.S. House member at the age of 87?
I think one of the biggest challenges he's going to have is the district he's running in. This is I'm not taking sides in this election, and certainly Parr is not. But when you look at this district, this 6th district, It was reformed in the redistricting just a couple of years ago. And what we saw was a district that could possibly have elected a Democrat, and in fact did elect a Democrat in the form of Don Cashew for at least a special election. It has become far more dominantly Republican and white. It's gone from about, let's say, more or less two-thirds of a white demographic to about three-fourths. And so I think the numbers are definitely going to be working against him there, because I think he has a stronger base among the black voters and among Democrats.
Okay. Is it Fabio or Fabio in Grand Coteau? A great name. Good morning to you. You're on with Robert Travis Scott.
Just to get back to that first caller, he called Jindal, I believe he used the word arrogant and elitist. I would like to add cowardly to him, because I don't believe the guy has ever set foot without calculating how it was going to play out for him politically. You go back to the legislative pay raises and the Snelly repeal. He was against it, and then he was for it. He seems to follow whatever way the political winds are blowing.
And yesterday in the Advocate, an editorial implied that the governor is switching positions on Common Core because of his national aspirations. Does Fabio have a point?
Well, I think this is in some ways a defining decision for Jindal on Common Core. This is a program that was adopted by the state under his administration, and he has, I think, been very vague about exactly how he comes down on it. He's kind of postponed the implementation of it, and it's not exactly clear how he's on board or how he's not on board with it. And I think as we go into this legislative session, in which there's a lot of bills about it and there's a lot of discussion about it, people are going to be looking to him to help clarify where he is on this issue. And right now, I don't think it's very clear. This Common Core, you know, discussion does have a fair amount of opposition. Whether it's a majority of opposition in the legislature remains to be seen, and we'll see that in this legislature. But it's a divided opposition. There are those who like the Common Core, but want to see the implementation done a little bit better, and certainly on some of the local levels in terms of preparation for implementing the Common Core, there needed to be some improvements. But you also have people who see this as a federal intrusion on the local
PAR taking
local
a stand?
School district. What we're in favor of the Common Core. We think it would be good to implement it.
Okay.
And then you also have people who really didn't like some of the education reforms of a couple of years ago. And these folks, I think, are looking for the Common Core as a way to leverage to push back on some of those reforms. So you have some strange bedfellows there all in all looking at the program.
Rick Causey writes, I would vote for Putin for president before I would vote for Bobby Jindal. That's how little I trust his abilities to lead. Harsh words from Rick Causey about Governor Bobby Jindal, saying that he would vote for the former head of the KGB over the man who was born right here in Baton Rouge on June 10th, 1971. I do think that Jindal has a better chance than Vladimir does of being the next president.
Хорошо.
297-5633, your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds with Robert Travis Scott of PAR. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. And Engster Show at WRKF.org. Colonel Henry Johnson writes that he has something nice to say about Governor Jindal. He says he probably loves his mother. That's from Colonel Henry Johnson, and I'm sure he does. His mother, by the way, is still a high-ranking member of state government and high-paid, working for the Workforce Development Agency.
Yeah, it was his mother who got the position at LSU to come over to the United States. She was a nuclear physicist and now works with, I think, computer and data processing.
If it were not for LSU, Bobby Jindal would not have been born in the United States, most likely, and he would not be eligible to be the next president of the United States.
Well,
so he owes a lot to LSU.
I don't know. If they hadn't come here, they might have gone somewhere else.
But they didn't have much time. If he'd been born in India, he wouldn't have been eligible.
Well, you make an interesting speculation there.
Well, she was several months pregnant when he came, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, I hear all the criticisms of Mr. Jindal. I think it's always important to take a balanced view of these things. I think the Jindal administration has done a very good job on economic development. I think they've been very professional in the way they've handled it. Our state clearly is more attractive as a industrial development or commercial development site now than it was, say, 10, 15 years ago. And I think that's been helped not only by Jindal, but the previous two governors, but I think his administration has done a good job. He's also, I think, on the spending side of government, he's done some of the things that Parr has wanted to see done, which is to hold down the number of state employees, which were just growing steadily over many years, and he's finally gotten a grip on that. He's practiced a lot of consolidation of government operations, trying to save money, and has done some privatization, some more controversial than others, but still, he's done a number of good things. Now, I'll be glad to also talk about some of the things I'm concerned about.
Okay, we'll get to that as well, but we have a few people waiting in line to talk with Robert Travis Scott in our remaining time with him. HB in Denham Springs, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, sir. Mr. Scott, would you agree in general terms that elected or appointed officials on a local, state, or national level are more afraid of you and organizations like you, as well as the investigative arm of news media? Are they afraid more so of these type of organizations than they are of law enforcement in general, of taking action or reading through the spin that they put out in uncovering corruption and false truths to the public?
Well, amen. I only wish we could instill fear in people, but I think what people look to Parr for is guidance. You know, what are good government practices? What are good fiscal practices? What are good ethical practices? What is open government? What makes for good open government? Where is it transparent and where is it not? And I think that's what we're seen as the research organization for. We look for fact-based information and views. When we do recommendations, we vet them out very thoroughly to people on all sides of the political equation so that we have a really good product when we're ready to go. And, you know, we have a lot of recommendations that are ready to go. And back when Edwin Edwards took office in his very first administration, he went through and started looking at all the Parr recommendations that were on the table at the time and started adopting a lot of those. And he was helped by the fact that when he first came into office there, what was it, 1972, there was a new legislature in place as well. We had had a new redistricting that the Public Affairs Research Council itself had done, according to the federal court's request by them for us to go in and do this. And for the first time, we had opportunities for African Americans to be represented. There was only one African American in the legislature up until that point. And it just stopped a lot of the gerrymandering that had been going on at that time. And so what we ended up with was a new governor who was reform-minded, looking at Parr for suggestions, and he also had a new legislature. Only 40% of the legislature were incumbents that came back in that election. And so that opened the door for him to create a constitutional convention and to do a number of other things that he wouldn't otherwise been able to do. I think that's been our role over the years. I think almost every administration has picked up on some of our recommendations.
2975633 is your number in our remaining time with Robert Travis Scott, the last 3 years head of the Public Affairs Research Council. Nate Silver, the noted political prognosticator, now has Mary Landrieu with a 55% chance of losing her seat. That was his updated forecast yesterday. She's up against some Republicans. The challenger who seems to be most likely to be in a runoff with her is Bill Cassidy, congressman from Baton Rouge. What do you think of this race?
Well, you'll have to get my friend Bernie Pincinet back in here to make the call on who will win that race. I don't know. It's always been a close race with
Mary every single time. What issues are going to be in play here?
Well, you know, Obama has been a really big issue in this state. He's not very popular. And I think what you've seen is Senator Landrieu trying to put a little distance between herself and Obama. And I think on the other side, people are going to be looking for Cassidy and these other candidates to, you know, assert what they would do and how they are really different. What is it they would take to Washington that would make them different from the sort of disappointing scene that we see up there right now? So it's an interesting race. Again, I can't call it. I don't intend to try to call it. But I'd say right now it's still a close one.
Chuck in a meet. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air with Robert Travis Scott. Hi, Chuck.
Hiya. I'm listening to all the negative comments about Governor Jindal. I think the man's a good governor. His response during Hurricane Gustav was, you know, right where it should be, and I have nothing but nice things to say about the man, except he talks a little fast.
Would you vote for him for president?
Absolutely.
Chuck and Amit. In God's country, he's a bullish on Bobby Jindal. Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate your remarks. And certainly we invite people who are supportive of the governor, and a lot of people are. After all, he's won two elections by heavy margins. The last one, almost two-thirds of the electorate went for him. But Bobby Jindal, if polls are accurate now, Robert, has suffered a severe downturn in support in Louisiana. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, you could look at it in the abstract and say if somebody does come along and make a lot of difficult reforms, that their numbers are going to go down. And I think that explains some of it. But it might also be partly, I think people are a little concerned that he is more obsessed with himself and his own political ambitions on a nationwide scale than he is with Louisiana. And that's a reputation that I think he's earned, and so he's probably going to suffer a little bit in popularity as a result of that. By the way, I was in the command center reporting at the time of Gustav, and it was a really well-run operation at that time, and he and his staff did a pretty remarkable job. There was a major evacuation of the area, especially the New Orleans area. Now, in the end, it turned out there didn't really need to be one because the storm hit us here in Baton Rouge and not New Orleans, but it would have been unconscionable not to conduct that evacuation at that time, especially so soon after Katrina. But it was an amazing evacuation, especially when you consider all the medical people in the medical facilities that had to be pulled out. And I think everybody came away from it saying, here's a guy who is well organized, he delegates, and then when you come back from having that delegated job, you better have an answer when you come back to the table about how it's going. And so we did get high marks for that. And I was in the command center for Katrina, and I think almost no matter who was governor, that would have been a chaotic situation, but it was chaos.
Well, come January 20th, 2017, perhaps Bobby Jindal will be the president of the United States, and Edwin Edwards will be taking his turn and his second term and his second tour of duty as a U.S. House member. Wouldn't that be something?
Well, that would be something, wouldn't it? Yeah. Well, there's some things that, you know, that I think Jindal needs to be careful about. And when he goes to the national stage talking about his fiscal conservatism, you know, we look back at his state budget, which raises a lot of concerns for us. We have this habit of borrowing from the future to balance our budget. Our regular operating revenues are out of sync with our operating expenses, and so we find ways to borrow from the future or to take money from pots of money that may be available that shouldn't be, and we apply them towards the budget. What that does is it's kind of like racking up your credit card to pay your utility bills. And you just make it harder and harder in the future to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing with this administration, and it's something that we have spoken up about and we would like to see change. Like, for example, they want to borrow money from the New Orleans Convention Center. It's basically a loan to help pay operating expenses this year, and they'd pay it back over time. So we're basically paying our operating expenses with a very expensive loan. And I don't see how that jibes very well with what Jindal wants to do on the national stage.
What about the money the governor turned down for broadband expansion, the money he turned down for a rail system from Baton Rouge to New Orleans? Were those prudent moves?
Well, on the rail system, there's a lot of arguments every way on that. That's a very difficult decision. I'd be glad to talk about that because there's a lot of pros and cons.
If you were governor, what would your choice have been?
I don't know. At the time, the amount of money and the type of program they were looking at was very expensive, and it was
$12 million a year for the state.
It was at least that, and it was a question about who was going to pay for that. Now they have a new study out, and it sounds like it's a little less expensive than what they had thought before. And I've not read that study. I've just read the stories about it, but it sounds like it's
so. You're not committal on rail system. What about broadband?
I'm not really that committal on rail. And I tell you, it's not something that we've done any particular studies about. So it wouldn't be appropriate for me to try to say whether it's a go or not. But there are a lot of other considerations. When you look at a lot of these studies on the rail, you look at the overall global savings that you make by reduced traffic and that sort of thing. So there's really two ways of looking at it. One is on an operational basis, are you able to make money or are you going to have to subsidize it? And the other, in the broader view, of the overall cost for the economy and society in terms of gasoline, road wear, and all that.
What about broadband?
Do you think
he made a good call on that one?
What about Medicaid?
What about Medicaid expansion?
Medicaid expansion is one in which we are coming out with a report here fairly soon that looks at some of the ways other states are using some of the Medicaid money to expand coverage to citizens in a state on the lower income level. The Medicaid expansion under Obamacare basically puts a lot of lower income adults on the Medicaid program, on the government Medicaid program. This has been rejected by Jindal. And I don't think the legislature is going to change that in this upcoming session. What you've seen a number of other states do is apply for a waiver to try an alternative type of program. For example, in Arkansas, where they use that federal money to allow lower income adults to obtain private coverage insurance in the private market. And it's been a controversial program in Arkansas, but it has been maintained. And there have been a number of other states like Pennsylvania that have suggested different ways of going about this. Now, I don't think any of those things are going to happen under the Jindal administration, but I think the next governor is going to have to look at some of those alternatives and explore whether or not there might be a better way to do this. Even Governor Bobby Jindal, when he first came in office, he had a trial program that he wanted to do in Lake Charles, which was basically Obamacare. It was about an exchange and extending Medicaid coverage to people in the lower income levels. But he has since backed off of that concept. And how much politics is
involved. So if you're governor, do you take the Medicaid money?
I think you look at these various other kind of waiver programs.
You're saying an Arkansas plan would be advisable?
Like I say, we're right now doing a study of the various different kinds of programs that are out there to see what would be feasible.
You're being very good at being non-committal. So yes or no, is the Arkansas plan good or bad, Robert?
I think the Arkansas plan is going to show us whether or not it's affordable or not. That's what we're waiting to see how much money it's going to cost them, whether or not
you're non-committal on this as well. Okay. Leonard Joseph says the organization for Gustav was put in place by the Blanco administration based on what they learned from Katrina. The Jindal administration gave the Blanco administration credit. Jindal won a high margin in the election for re-election when the voter turnout was very low. You and your guests need to do your homework. That's from Leonard Joseph.
Well, he's partly right. I mean, I think we learned a lot of lessons in Katrina, and there were some procedures put in place that they did follow in Gustav. But the overall management system and how it operated was night and day. And I not only did my homework, I was there, had a front row seat, unfortunately.
He did a nice job with Gustav, but it was his first year as governor. And I would imagine most of the operations were put in place by his predecessor based on the catastrophe that we had during Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, like for example, I think that they had a contract to bring in buses if buses were needed for an evacuation. And when the time came at Gustav, the the company just couldn't deliver the buses, and so there was a crisis there trying to get enough vehicles in here to make that work. So, you know, even some of the things that were planned didn't work out quite as well when the storm hit.
Questions from listeners. One about minimum wage. What does Parr think about raising the minimum wage?
We've never had a position on minimum wage. That's never been one that we've really really addressed.
Payday loans?
Yeah, you know, we haven't studied that. I'm interested to see what will happen that during the session. The Louisiana Budget Project has done, I think, a good job, you know, advancing that agenda, and there's this concern that lower-income people who aren't using the usual banking system are being hit with some really high rates through the financial system that they are using, and that maybe there's a way to sort of cut back on the kind of rates that those people are paying.
All right. Faye, listening in Washington, D.C., mentions a previous discussion with both you and David Hood, who was on this show. He issued a report under the Parr banner saying that the Medicaid expansion would be a good thing. But that was that David Hood talking or was that Parr talking?
I don't know which one you're talking
this
about.
This was last year. He said the governor was off
that wasn't target. That wasn't a Parr study.
He
hasn't done a Parr study for
us in
a long while. Now, what we did last year, we felt our role in this had been so politicized, this Medicaid expansion, that we needed somebody in the middle who was able to sort of call balls and strikes in this. And one of the things we did last year is we came out with a report saying, look, you folks at the Department of Health and Hospitals, we know you've got studies back there showing the real long-term impact of a Medicaid expansion. There are a lot of new factors now that we know about through the regulations, and you need to come forward and let us know what your real long-term impact scenarios are. And they had balked on doing that. But once we put out that report, they in fact did put out a report, and it actually was a pretty good one, where they looked at what the long-term impacts of a Medicaid expansion would be. And under a really worst-case scenario, the state would have been losing money. But under a better-case scenario, actually the state would come out on the positive end financially. So we were glad we were able to, you know, push them forward and be a little more transparent about what they really thought was going on.
Okay. Well, always good to talk with you. Robert Travis Scott of Parr, who follows goings-on at the Capitol and elsewhere as closely as anybody. Thank you. And we'll be back with a look at Spill, major production, Swine Palace. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Inkster's show at WRKF.org. In studio are Lee Fondakowski and Reva Wortel, and they are involved with Spill, a major production at the Riley Theater, and it's ongoing right now. It's been on stage now since March 12th, so almost 2 weeks, and will continue through this week. And it is a production about the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe of 4 years ago. Good morning again.
Good morning.
Nice to see both of you, and you've gotten some national attention, including on NPR.
Yes.
I'm glad you're getting some well-deserved recognition for a play about oil.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make oil interesting?
Well, this story is pretty interesting. It's a pretty dynamic story. The first act of the play starts about 2 weeks before the blowout on the Deepwater Horizon, and we follow a few of the rig workers as they're leaving for their last hitch out there. And the first act really takes you through the explosion and the fire on board the Horizon, and it's a story of survival. It's a very dramatic story of how the men survived. And the second act is the story of the oil spill and how the people of Louisiana, southern Louisiana, were impacted and responded to the spill.
We're hearing the voice of Lee Fondakowski, and we're about to hear from Reva Wortel as well. And Lee got her early attention for working on the Laramie Project.
That's right. And that's one of the inspirations to dig a little bit deeper into the story of oil. Here in the South, I was at a talkback for a production of the Laramie Project, and somebody asked me, you know, somebody asked me what I was working on, and I said I was working on Spill. And she said, oh, that's a different kind of sadness, comparing the sadness of the oil spill and the rig workers' lives who were lost to the life of Matthew Shepard. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she really couldn't explain any further other than to say that Matthew Shepard was a victim that we should care about. And I was very struck by that, and Reva and I were both very struck by that, and it made us kind of dig deeper into the oil industry, something I didn't know very much about before I started studying this, and really portray those lives on stage.
Well, Lee was the head writer for the Laramie Project, and in your production of Spill, oil comes across as an entity with human qualities.
Yes, it does. Do you want to talk about that, Reva? Lillian Miller's quote?
Yeah. Lillian speaks about, she was a former, Lillian Miller was a former roustabout. She worked on oil drilling rigs for about 7 years. And she speaks about the well like a living creature, like it's a, and she has this quote about like it's riding, like it's like breaking a wild horse. That's what she says. And so it really, it puts this interesting tension on the job of the rig worker that I think people don't, Americans don't know generally about that.
How technically advanced the you know, it is off there, out there. She says that the job of the rig workers is to listen to this entity.
Well, Reva is a visual artist of renown, and she painted portraits of all the people in the production, right?
Yeah, I did. And the portraits are on display in the lobby of the Riley Theater. There are several life-size portraits in the lobby, and then there's also a surprise element in the production. At the end of the show, there's some also some portraits that get revealed of the people that are in the play.
Well, Spill explores the rich culture of our state and the resilient nature of our inhabitants in the face of natural destruction and tragedy. 11 people died, and hundreds of millions of gallons of oil were dispensed on our shoreline. And you went down there, didn't you?
We did. We went down there, and we went back many, many times over the course of a few years' time, interviewing people, fishermen, marina owners, all people down the coast, and sort of stayed in touch, people who worked on Vessels of Opportunity, and stayed in touch with them over the years. So the play follows them through the immediate aftermath, but also follows them up to 2 years after.
Well, there's an environmental cost of this tragedy, and then there's the human cost, and both of those are profound.
Both of those are profound, and I think that's one of the tensions that the play brings out, is there were 11 men who were lost, and then this unstoppable spill quickly took over. You know, there wasn't a person in the country who wasn't watching that spill cam in the corner of their TVs in that summer of 2010. And the play draws out the tension between the family members who lost their kids and their husbands, their sons, and saying, our story was quickly overtaken by this catastrophic spill. And so there's a tension between that human loss and the loss of other species and the land that is part of the narrative of Spill.
And this is one of those stories like the airline tragedy that captivates the world.
It did captivate the world. I mean, what's interesting about that too, Jim, is that when in 87 days when we stopped, finally stopped the blowout, I think most of America, and BP has done a pretty good job with their advertising in this regard too, that most of America thought it was over. And it wasn't until you came back here and talked to the people, and even now you go down to Point Lahash and you talk to those fishermen, and there's people who are still impacted. There are you know, people whose lives were changed forever by this. And I think most of America was just like, phew, thank God that's over. Yeah. We stopped that. We don't have to worry about that anymore. And the story was basically forgotten.
You noted that when you went down there and people were referring to people who live up north, they weren't referring to Minnesota, were they?
No, they weren't. That was one of the big shockers down in La Rose, actually talking to a woman named Rose in La Rose. And she said, well, it's different here from up north. And I sincerely thought she meant New York. And so I said, to New York. And she said, no, not New York, Baton Rouge. So it was my first sort of education in how insular actually it is in the south. And it's really like a different world
in the south coast of Louisiana.
What is the big change when you move north to the north country of Baton Rouge, Reva?
What is the big change? I think there's a sense of rural life down there, and there's a real familial sense where everybody knows each other and takes care of each other. And I think once you get closer to the city, things become more disparate between people, generally speaking. So I think that's one of the major differences that I've noticed in all places in the country, but particularly here in Louisiana.
And really making your living off the land and being tied to the land in a way that I've never experienced before.
Mm-hmm. How did this change the state based on what you've seen?
That's an interesting question. I think one of the things that's really struck me about this story is particularly talking to the oil worker families, not from here, I presume that people would say, well, we had a huge spill, we should stop drilling, right? And so my education in realizing how the whole economy, not just of Louisiana, but really the world runs on this industry. And so it's been interesting to see how these extraction technologies advance and as collectively the risks involved, and wondering how much risk are we willing to take, and what are the changes that are going to be made in the industry based on if we're going to go into these areas, are we prepared for what can go wrong?
This certainly didn't kill BP.
No, it certainly didn't. And very recently, since our production has opened, they got their lease rights back in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that's something has occurred also.
And I wonder if anyone from BP has been to the Riley Theater.
If they have,
they haven't spoken to us. But
yet.
Tony Hayward is represented in the play. He does speak and have some words.
Probably one of the lines is, I need to get my life back together.
You had to put that in there. Actually, it was my father told me that. My father saw an early reading of the play, and he said, you can't do this play unless you put that line in, because that's the most famous line.
But so far, people have laughed. It's been a moment where everyone's just like, oh, there we go. There it is.
Well, tragedies happen, and this is not a business without some danger, but it appears that there were some major problems with the way BP was doing business in the Gulf, which affects our way of life.
Yeah, some negligence there too, yeah.
And
finding out the degree of negligence was also one of the shocking things about the story.
What degree of negligence?
Finding out how, all the cost cutting that was done, and, had they had 7 rigs in the Gulf and they only mm-hmm. owned one, and that was the one that they had extra safety on, the ones mm-hmm. that they didn't own, they didn't have the extra safety measures. It's just, point after point of compromises there.
But most candidates for public office in Louisiana, they embrace the oil and gas industry. Mm-hmm. We've got a U.S. Senate race, and the positions by the Democrat and the Republican challengers are extremely close. There's not a whole lot of challenging of the oil industry, with a few exceptions, people like Foster Campbell and General Honoré. And Foster Campbell has tried to run for Congress and for governor and has not been successful. Big oil has big power.
It's true. I think one of our characters says it best. There's a character named Bob B. He's an engineer, studies disasters. That's his specialty. And he says, in America, we have decided as a society that it's not okay to die on an airplane, right? So the safety measures that are put in place for air safety travel, I mean, the Malaysian flight is a tragedy, but if you think back to the Southwest incident not too long ago, they grounded all the planes, they fixed the problem, and then they put them back in the air because the American public demands that it's not okay to die when you fly. And in this industry, we've heard a lot in just studying this story of people saying, well, those men out there, they make good money, they know what they're getting themselves into, that you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And when does the American public say that it's not okay to die on an oil rig, and when is it not okay to take risks when you actually don't have the safety measures in place if something goes wrong?
Of course, the industry has also created lots of jobs. That's and right. Has made a good living for a lot of people in Louisiana through generations. And so that has to be taken into account. And we certainly, as a country, can't rely on a world without oil.
That's
so it
right.
has to come from somewhere.
It definitely right. does.
But I think one of the messages that comes out in our talkbacks that we've had so far is that there are students and people that are coming that are feeling closer to the oil. So if you're removed from it and you don't understand the culture or the people that work on the rig, there's a sense of feeling more familiar with what that life is like and the risk and reward that comes with it, and how we're all connected to it and that we all need it for our iPhones and our cars and our every aspect of our lives. I think people are walking away from spill feeling that and understanding that in a deeper way.
There's nothing more ugly than an oil spill, and here it is in an area that is full of all of nature's blessings. There was a disconnect when you looked at that. The natural habitat being spoiled by something so ugly, and really, that area has not, 4 years later, but hasn't really recovered from this.
Yeah, it really hasn't recovered from it. And the scientists that we've spoken to even on this trip are saying, you know, it's going to be another 10 years before we get the full impact of what went on down there.
Well, what are you trying to convey in the play? What should people come away with after they see Spill?
I think for me, it's very different doing this play in other parts of the country than it is doing it here in Louisiana. When we do it in other parts of the country, my real goal is that people are able to put a human face on where their energy comes from, to actually realize that there are lives at stake in our consumption, in our global consumption. And so that's the real purpose. Here, I think people have more of a sense of that. They know they live every day with the erosion and other issues of land loss that have, you know, the oil industry has contributed to. So I think here in Louisiana, people are more aware of the cost of oil, but our message coming out of here is for people to really get that human connection.
Mm-hmm. How does this project, Riva, differ in any way from others you have done?
Well, I think this project in particular is different because we are we're talking about something like oil, like we're saying that is affects there. You know, I come from Portland, Oregon, and there's a lot of environmentalists there. And I was telling Lee the other day that I saw a bumper sticker there that says, there was a person driving in front of me that said, "Stop offshore drilling." And it hit me in this way, like, wow, this person's driving this car, and they're saying, "Stop offshore drilling." So I think this story, you know, this idea, this sort of the heated hot button issue of oil and the environmentalists and the sort of the fight and the debate that happens, we're sort of plowing through that and saying we're all included in this discussion. So if you're going to have, like, making those kinds of statements and acting as if you're not somehow related to the industry, or somehow using this incredible, precious energy resource, I think you're in denial. So I think in that way, we're sort of puncturing the status quo around it. And I think people, there's no agenda with this story. It's trying to affect people, all kinds of people.
The production of Spill is based on interviews with South Louisiana residents in the wake of the spill 4 years ago next month, and the art installation includes life-size portraits of those interviews and extends the life of the story past the play's final scene. The play and the visual installation are seen this week at the Riley Theater on Tower Drive, Wednesday through Sunday, right?
That's right.
And the Wednesday through Sunday performances are at 7:30, and there's another one on Sunday at 2 p.m.
That's right.
And there's still an opportunity, if you wish to see Spill, to do so. And as you stated, Lee, you're getting attention all over the country on this one.
We are getting attention over the country. And what's interesting is I think there is a presumption, based on my work on the Laramie Project, maybe, that this I have a liberal agenda with this project. So I have started getting some negative tweets about my propaganda machine called Spill. And I always find it very interesting. I find it very interesting as an artist when you're trying to draw out a complex story, like you're saying, right? Well, where are we going to get our energy from, America? Trying to draw out the question, trying to draw people into the dialogue, and how the presumption is made, if you're an artist, that you're on the liberal left, and the piece is anti-oil and propaganda against the oil industry, and really sort of fighting that perception, because we've gone pretty deep into the lives of the people who lost a lot, and we really want to share that with the rest of the world.
Would you encourage someone to go to work on an oil rig based on what you know now?
In certain situations, if Lillian Miller was here, I think she might say, question whether those offshore rigs are safe even today. I think she and some of the characters that we interviewed still lose sleep over the deep water rigs, and the safety measures that may or may not have been implemented after this tragedy.
Well, thank you, Lee Fondakowski and Reba Wartell. Fine production of Spill, ongoing this week, 7:30 on Wednesday through Sunday at the Riley Theater on Tower Drive, and 2 p.m. on Sunday as well. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.